This is Dr. Charles Parker, and you're listening to Core Brain Journal. It's a place where I connect both fresh discoveries and interesting different perspectives from advanced mind science with the realities of real people and everyday life down on Main Street.
Well, welcome, folks. Once again, we're back here at Core Brain Journal, and we're so happy to have you with us. We've got a very, very interesting guest today, a person that we really need to just strap the seatbelt on and listen to, because she's going to tell us some things that are just rampant, pervasive in society nowadays about suicide, about recovery from suicide. And she, get this, is a suicide recovering person. And the fact that she's coming out with this and talking about it is at the very least evocative, but at the very best, a serious lesson plan on what to do and how to think about it. So our guest today is Nancy Verdine. Verdine. Okay, I put it out phonetically and didn't do it right after all. Verdine, thank you. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about Nancy, and then we'll go ahead and talk more about who she is and where she is. So she lives in Cleveland, Ohio. She is an author, a mental health and recovery advocate, and a founder of Always the Fight Ministries. Since 2012, Nancy has shared her story at conventions, schools, and churches from the East Coast to Chicago, my kind of town. She has contributed to articles in such publications as Newsweek. Let's see what that says. Newsweek Japan and Health Monitor
Newsweek
Magazine.
Japan.
Yeah, I had to get the reading right. And to websites such as theexaminer.com and domesticshelters.org. And she's really loves doing these shows because she's really trying to get the word out to the community, just as we are, on options for care that make a difference. And that's really what we're talking about. So, Nancy, thank you so much for joining us. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself on a personal level?
Absolutely. I would like to tell you my story, first of all, and that will give us the foundation for the rest of the conversation. In January of 2011, I tried to end my life. Part of the problem, if you will, as far as having something to point to, if that's necessary, is that I had just made a major move from Cleveland to the Philadelphia area, and I had marriage problems there. I had no new friends in that area. I stopped being compliant with meds, which is always, you know, a great thing. There was all this buildup, and eventually it went beyond my ability to cope. There was low energy, no desire to live, only me and my pain. That was all I was, comprehending, was me and pain. There's great hopelessness, a heavy weight on my shoulders. It was like this shroud had come down out of the sky, figuratively, and as it was coming down and shadowing around me, it was like my view was becoming grayer and grayer, and the lights were becoming dimmer and dimmer, and then it rested on my shoulders, and all I could see was blackness. And that remained a weight to the point that if I was laying down, I could feel it when I was trying to sit back up. If I was trying to, not get out of bed because I was so depressed, it would pin me to my sheets. Not literally, of course, but it felt so heavy. I remember that laughter hurt. I remember that conversation hurt. There was some sort of an empty cavern on the inside of me that I have never been able to explain. It was like there's a huge hole in my middle, and I couldn't fill it. And there were times that I would see other people who were laughing, and they seemed to be happy, and all I could perceive was, they're happy, I'm not. I couldn't see anything else. I couldn't see any of the gray areas. And so part of that cavernous feeling was, I'm not like everybody else. Everybody else is happy except for me. I had no hope for change. I felt unloved and valueless, that nothing I could produce would be worth, continuing the decades-long pain I'd been feeling. And as I said, I'd come to the end of my ability to cope. My suicide attempt in January of 2011 landed me in the hospital. And in the hospital, I remember just feeling so shocked that I was still alive. It was like I couldn't even grasp that reality for a little while. I remember walking the halls and just kind of hugging the walls because of the lowest of energy, the lowest of motivation, and fear, great fear, and just a sense of deadness as well. And it was difficult, and I remember people were saying to me, you know, how can you avoid this in the future? And of course they were trying to give me the answers to that. But I remember thinking, these are the questions I thought I'd put behind me for good. I'd experienced major depression before, and these questions were familiar, and it was like I thought I was not going to have to do this again. They were asking me, like, how do you, you know, let's figure out what you want to do today. Do you want to do art therapy? Do you want to do a group thing? And my response on the inside was, why do I care? I'm supposed to be dead, and I want to be dead. And unfortunately, that led to a second suicide attempt in the hospital. Mm. My thinking was generally throughout my life, really, I guess it's fair to say, was that there was this loud, constant, negative inner voice that I was guilty in every situation, every relationship. I was hurting people. I was unlovable, stupid, weird. I didn't matter. All of these kinds of thinking. And it was once I got out of the hospital and into intensive care, intensive therapy cares, you know, an IOP, intensive outpatient program, is when I started to hear things that I had not heard before that were contrary to how I had always thought. So that was interesting. I remember being really surprised. One of the first things that I remember hearing in this IOP program was that it's okay for me to get my needs met. I remember sitting straight up in my chair. I was like, what? You mean that's not selfish? It's okay? Wow. I think that not only my experience as just a human, but also my training as a Christian had been incomplete and had steered me the wrong way, that I was supposed to be sacrificial 100% of the time, and that if I thought about myself, it was wrong. So when I started to hear that it's okay to get my needs met, I was amazed. And that was the first of my lessons, I would say, in self-care and how important self-care is. I signed up for an art class at that point because the psychologist asked me, what do you need to have in order to know joy? And my answer was creativity. I have to have creativity or I shrivel up into nothing. And so I signed up for an art class, and it started to change my attitude towards it's not, you know, from I'm not worth anything to maybe it's okay for me to spend a little time on me. Mm. The second lesson that I received was that core beliefs exist. I didn't know this. I thought, okay, I'm Nancy, I'm a wife, I'm a mother, I'm a Christian, I have certain ideas, certain opinions, these are my beliefs. What I didn't know is that deep down inside, and I was completely really unaware of these, I could not have expressed them to you on a conscious level, I had these core beliefs that were actually running my life. And the discovery of those allowed me to enter the process of changing them. One of them was that I believed emotions were weakness, period. So if you felt excited about something, you should more or less keep it to yourself. If you felt sad about something, you're definitely supposed to keep that to yourself. And strong emotions, pretty much anything in between, or, you know, at the extremes of either end, were definitely not to be shared, and it was shameful to do so. I didn't realize that was running my life, but it was. And so what was happening is I was, of course, very, holding everything in and not really being open with people. But I was also feeling guilty when an emotion escaped me.
How was that? Explain that, if you will, please.
Okay, well, if I had a happy day and I was excited about an achievement or something like that, and I shared it with somebody, I would feel bad at the same time because I wasn't supposed to be sharing it.
Yes, I understand.
Okay, that kind of guilt. And so it was never, real freedom. But I believed I will never be good enough. I believed all people are false. Probably the one that has been the hardest for me to overcome, and probably it affected my life at the deepest level, was an ingrained belief that women are worth what men say they are worth. Mm. That's a tough one for me, but I'm still working on it. Intellectually, of course, I can say, no, I know that's not true. So these core beliefs, as they were being uncovered, I realized I was also being taught, of course, how to address them and change more or less the direction of my life by facing these negative false beliefs.
Unbelievable. I mean, you have said so very much in just a few minutes here. It's hard for anybody out there to think on any level they just don't get it. I mean, this is so real and so articulately put. I mean, and I've been doing this for 45 years, so I've heard a lot of people talk about how bad it was for them. But you made it remarkably explicitly clear, and thank you very much for sharing that. I mean, that's an amazing ability to actually talk about it with such meaning and in such a balanced way.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
So how did you overcome the female thing with the guys? How do you work on that one?
Well, for me, that's an evidence-based argument. I have to, when I'm wanting to assume that, then I have to go through the evidence. What, Nancy, have you done that is worthwhile? How do you know you have value aside from somebody telling you this? And of course, I've got answers to those questions now. And I can also look at the other person and I can say, how does this man have the power to make this decision for me? And once I go through that process of looking at the evidence and seeing that they really don't have any power and that I really do have value without their opinion, I can get past it. But it's still a battle sometimes. That was just ingrained at a very young age. So
very, very, very interesting.
One story that I tell people, I remember the first time I told it, I was embarrassed, but I'm still embarrassed, but I still go around telling it anyway. And that is that, I'm 54 now, and I was 49 when I attempted suicide. So in the last 5 years has been all this growth. And one of the things that I believe I discovered around the age of 52 is that music is emotional. Now, that's got to sound nuts to people, but I could have told you that music could move you, and I could have responded to music in that way. What I did not understand is that it was supposed to, and that when I responded to music, I wasn't doing something wrong. That I couldn't have told you, because feelings were wrong to have, remember?
Yeah.
So right around 52, I was watching The Voice, actually, and Adam said something about one of his clients needing to put more emotion into his song, and he said something about, that's why we're here, man, that's why we're doing this, and it just went off in my head. I just realized, oh my gosh, the whole world does emotions.
Oh, what a shock. What a complete shock.
It was funny at the time, and it's still funny. It's just, I went back to my support group later that week and said that, and everybody just stared at me like I was the strangest thing, but it was the light bulb for me.
Well, you were just trying so hard. You know, you were really, really trying hard to be right based on external circumstances rather than your own internal circumstances.
Correct.
And some of them were male related, but some of them were just philosophically related. Some of them were religious related in terms of the way you heard the religious structure.
That's right. That's correct. Yeah, one of my false beliefs was that God's love is just pity. And I've since uncovered the truth of that, that his love for his children is passion. And he's not looking at me going, oh, I have to love you, I guess. So, yeah.
Wow.
Go ahead.
I'm just amazed. You're doing such a great job. I love listening to you. There's nothing for me to say here, I'll tell you that. You've got such interesting information. But say what you were going to say. I do have a question gelling here, but go ahead and finish your sentence.
You know what? Start with your question because that might be where I'm going anyway.
Well, I think it probably is because I think one of the really interesting things about your contribution to others and the listeners for this program is that you've also actually put together an idea about how you can actually help people who are hurting without hurting yourself. So you're actually helping others, even in just discussing this in a real way, without in fact harming yourself. Could you talk about that, please?
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to start at the very beginning on how to help hurting people before I get to the part about not hurting yourself. I have noticed, and you've noticed, I've seen it on your website, and you've said it, and your guests have said it, there's stigma. There are beliefs and myths out there about depression and suicide and other mental health issues that are kind of controlling, in a way, the conversation. And we have basically people saying, you know, what I see and what I know is true, and not being particularly interested in learning something more. That's a human nature thing, and some people really are there. But even people who seem to be interested and possibly wanting to help or wanting to know more, they're really, really good with the platitudes. And platitudes are just simplifying the problem and offering a one-dimensional solution. So you've got a body, mind, and spirit that's all intertwined, and each one is affecting the other. And you talk about, also one of your guests talked about how the brain has its networks too, and there's all of those things interacting with each other. And these mental health issues end up being so complex. But I've heard things like, I heard somebody referring to Robin Williams after he died. They said he had access to the best drugs. He must be a coward. Mm. As if the drugs were the solution, the only solution, okay? I've heard somebody say, stop being so negative, or, you know, go talk to someone, but don't take meds, as if the only solution was to get your thoughts in order. And then I've heard, in the Christian realm, I've heard people say, just pray more, read the Bible more, and give it to Jesus. And none of these things helped me. They just added more guilt and hopelessness. Because if my belief was that I'm not worth anything, or I don't have control over my life, something like that, then for someone to tell me one of those ideas that you can just give it to Jesus or, you know, take the right drugs, my reasoning, because of the false beliefs, would be I need to be more compliant, more submissive, more self-sacrificing, because this is my value, right? Now, no medication, no platitude, spiritual or otherwise, was going to address that. And so if I thought, well, I would have thought, you know, I'm sure I did, that if I want to be loved, I'd better please people. But since people are false and I cannot be loved, I would keep hitting a wall and get depressed. Now, that cycle's not going to change by popping a pill or by you know, addressing the spiritual issues only. That is a complex situation that for me was only addressed through, first of all, the medications helping my brain be able to reason, mm-hmm. and then the learning to reason by discovery of all these things, which for me was talk therapy. And the spiritual issues kind of came along with all of that. They were not the answer in and of themselves. So when I talk to people about helping someone that they know who's hurting, one of the first things I do is explain depression and explain suicide. I want them to have some knowledge to work from before they just jump off the deep end and tell people, you know, platitudes and bad advice. Let's find out what depression is and how it works and how it may be working in the mind of your loved one. That's the first thing I do. The second thing I do is we look into insight into that person. I teach people to ask the hurting person questions, specific questions, like, what do you need? What do you need from me? And then what do you need from me today? Or what do you need from me right now? Because we're running around thinking, oh, I know what they need. They need to get out of bed. Or I know what they need. They need to go for a walk. And we're really good at telling this person who's barely functional that they need to go do this, that, and the other thing. Sometimes we're on top of it, and we offer to do that thing with them. But we still have something of a mindset of we know what they need, when in fact we need to ask them. It's possible they don't know, and that's okay too. But we need to gain some insight into that person. We need to look at the whole person. Who were they before they got depressed? Is this person really lazy? Is this person really someone who doesn't want to play with their children? This is probably something that's a result of depression, and they didn't just change their character overnight and become these people who don't want to function the way you want them to function. So looking into the person and then turning that insight towards yourself. Why do I want to help? Am I being controlling, or do I just have a concern? Do I want to help because I'm a people pleaser and it's satisfying me in some way? There's so many more questions, but it's a look at who you are, and then it moves into a look at what you have to offer. After people take in their limitations, that could include their schedule, agendas, that sort of thing, and take in their skills, I might not be able to bring you to your doctors because I don't have a car, okay? Maybe my skill is more I can call you on Wednesday nights or something. So after people look at their limitations, what they can and cannot do, what their skills are and opportunities, what they have to offer and what they don't have to offer, and then look at their priorities. What else in life are you committed to? Learn what you have to say yes to. Then you'll know what to say no to. And so we write down our priorities. We have a process for doing that. And then we come up with what is basically the purpose of the seminar, and that is we develop our boundaries. So we're saying to the hurting person now, what is it you need? What do you need from us? From me. What do you need from me right now? And we're talking not out of ignorance, but we're talking out of this is what I have to offer. And we're not making promises we can't keep. So, yeah, I have Wednesday nights from 7 to 8, and I would love to spend that time with you. I cannot skip school to stay home with you. Do you need to be somewhere where you'll be safe? Are you going to kill yourself? These kinds of questions. It's a 4-hour seminar, so I'm trying to wrap this up into a few minutes. It's not going to work.
But, no, you're doing an excellent job, because I'm going to just take a minute to give you a breath here. But what's really going on is you're talking, one of the limitations is, as you know, because we talked about it offline before, one of my pet peeves is thinking about human beings in a reductionistic way.
That's right.
And saying, okay, this is the label, this is what we do with this label, and
that's
this
right.
is what the group thinks should be done with this label. And because you have that label, that puts you in this box. And what by inherently is built into that process is keeping the person in the box that they're already mixed up about being stuck in the first place.
Oh, yes, of course. Well, I just lost my train of thought. But there that never happens, right?
Well, you were going with where you were going to go. I'll remind you, because you were taking it where you were going to go with the caregiver having a sense of boundaries and who they are as a person, and introducing that interface between the caregiver and the person who's suffering, and how to manage that boundary interface is what you were talking about.
Yes, and I have a really excellent example of that I put in story form, and maybe it will be more helpful for some. I had, during the time that I was deeply depressed, anybody could have come up to me, people that I cared about, people that I didn't care about, people who have a history of loving me, people who didn't. It doesn't matter who it was. If they came up to me and said, I care, I immediately didn't believe them. This was the depression talking, and it was part of the core belief that I have no value, but it was everything was exaggerated with the depression, you know, so it was just unbelievable that anybody could care. Now, because I wanted them to care, I would try to demand certain attentions. So, for instance, I had a friend stop by and say, you know, I'm just wondering if there's anything I can do for you. I'm praying for you. I care about you. And I said, I would like to have a phone call every day. I had only been able to articulate that because I'd been in therapy some already. But I thought, okay, that's what I need. Every day I'm telling myself that this is the day I could die. And I just need a phone call every day and somebody letting me know they care. Well, then she called. And I remember thinking, that phone call was too short. She doesn't really care.
Mm.
And that's just kind of the mindset I had with depression. Now, if she had, I don't remember articulating that to her, but let's say I did. Let's say I said to her, well, that was okay, but it wasn't good enough. Your phone call was a half hour. I want 2 hours next time. And then so the next day she calls me and gives me 2 hours. And then I say, you know what? I want you to come over and talk to me for 5 hours. And I was like, I mean, I could have pushed it. I did not. But you can imagine a situation, especially if you're living with someone. She just came over to visit. When you're living with someone, those demands or the lack of response to what you're trying to do to be kind can be really frustrating to you. And if you don't have your boundaries and know what it is okay to say yes and what is okay to say no to, you're going to get lost in it. And that's the part of how to help hurting people without hurting yourself. Understand that you matter too. That depressed, sick person matters, but so do you, by golly. And if you start not taking care of your needs, you're not only going to have your own issues, but you're not going to really be there for that other person either. One of the things that I discovered is that when you don't have boundaries, you very likely will end the relationship. It's not going to be a healthy, I can be here for you and I can help in this and that way, and I can't help in this and that way, so I'm going to, you know, keep my own sanity. It won't be that. If you don't have the boundaries and you're just trying to hop through every hoop that you think that you think they're asking you to hop through, or you're creating your own hoops because you're thinking this is what they need, you're going to burn out.
Well, you're going to feel guilty. You're going to feel guilty yourself, and you got to get away from feeling guilty. So
exactly.
You know, so the couple of other words that come to mind, and this is sort of the difficult thing of any mental health professional coming along. And surprising, a lot of mental health professionals don't even know this really articulate conceptualization of what's going on. But to just put it in mental health vernacular, if you'll forgive me for a moment, the difference is between empathy and sympathy.
Yes.
So what happens is with sympathy, a person who's sympathetic involved has what's called a trial identification with the person. They go over into that other person's place, their emotions, their life, their pain, and they can get stuck there. in sympathy and lose themselves. What you're saying is that the caretaker has to know themselves. That's what the boundaries are all about. Or they can go over there and get stuck in the trial identification. Whereas an empathetic response, which is constructive to everybody, because the person who is suffering needs a real person out there rather than an imaginary person who is all over the place, who has a real identity. And a trial on an empathetic response, there's a trial identification you go over and live within that person, and it's not gender specific. I mean, a male can do it with a female, an adult can do it with a child can do it with an adult.
Right.
So they go over in that with that other person, and then they come back to themselves to constructively add something to the misperceptions of the suffering individual. But if you don't come back, you're really no good to anybody, including yourself.
Oh, that's right. I talk to teenagers about this on occasion. I get to go into high schools on occasion. And what I have given them as a visual is the idea that we all live in these cylinders that you can't see out of. And so you're just walking down the school halls, right? We're walking through life bumping into each other because we can't really see. And everything in our cylinders, of course, is about us. So if we want to know more about other people and about the world outside of ourselves, we have to put a window in our cylinder. But that doesn't teach us everything, and that does not create meaningful relationships. If we want to have meaningful relationships, we have to build a door in our cylinders. And so we have to step out. Other people have to invite us in. We have to invite people in to our cylinders. But the danger there is moving in and living in somebody else's cylinder. Because as soon as you do that, you've given up everything that is you in order to, you know, be there, live their life, be their person. So that's not having boundaries.
So true. And that's a great metaphor or picture. It's definitely, I can imagine that the students really appreciate that because they can, it's so real. It's easy to understand what the nature of the problem is there.
I make them draw it.
Oh, you do? That'll really get them into it. Fantastic. Well, you know, we're zooming out of time here, and I just wanted to bring this to a little bit of a conclusion. And I'll be very honest with you, I really don't want to bring it to a conclusion. And I know there are a lot of listeners out there that feel exactly the same way I do. I mean, what a constructive, beautiful few moments we've had together here. It's just, it's amazing. Really very interesting person, and you've really done a lot of really productive and helpful work by the way you've reconceptualized yourself. And so you have a couple of books that you've offered to our listeners, and I'm sure they're going to be happy to hear about it. What happens is you have two books, and you know the names better than I do. I've got one is Called to Life, A Called to Live, A Chronicle of Recovery from After Attempted Suicide.
Yes.
And the second one is Always the Fight, A Living Testimony of What Only God Can Do. And what's happened is Nancy's been kind enough to offer them to our listeners as a giveaway. And so what's going to happen is if you go to corebrainjournal.com/022drawing, DRAWING, and put that in there, it'll take you to a page. You can leave your email address and identifying information. We'll have a drawing for both books, and we'll get them out. Now, this is going to be actually published sometime. Right now, we're in the late part of April, and so it's going to be late May, early June before it's actually published. But no matter, when you hear this and it's out, we're going to keep that drawing open for 2 weeks from the date of publishing. So it's not going to be forever, and so we have to close it down to finish the job for Nancy so she's not waiting till the very last person comes in. So it'll be a 2 week opening, and we'll announce it. We'll put it on social media as well, and it'll be on her show notes, as will some of the other identifying things that Nancy's been talking about. So in closing, Nancy, as I really do hate to close, but I think we really should because we're a little over time anyway. But if you'd leave us where people could get connected with you and how to make that connection, that would be great.
Sure. It's easy. It's just my name. It's Nancy Verdon, and that's spelled V as in Victor, IRDEN.com. That's it, nancyverdon.com. And everything you want to know about me and more is there.
That's great.
And the books are there, and what I will come and speak to your group about is there, and my blog is there, which goes out twice a week.
Fantastic. Well, and we're going to have on the show notes three books that Nancy has recommended for your consideration. So if you come over to Core Brain Journal and look at the show notes over there, she's got three additional books she's taken the time to put down that she uses as references and in her own consideration of where she's going in her life. So, Nancy, thank
yes.
you so much. Very, very interesting. It's been wonderful. I look forward to having you back.
I'd love to come back.
We'll do it sometime down the road, and because you have so much to offer. And I'll be looking forward to seeing what the comments are about this presentation, because I don't even want to call it a presentation. It's a very meaningful conversation, and I'm just happy to have been part of it.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Core Brain Journal. We're working every day behind the scenes to bring you reports that connect research benches with those street trenches. Here we share the complexity of mind science because, as you know, details really do matter. One of the most pervasive, misunderstood challenges is how commonplace medications, like those written for ADHD, are used so regularly without clear guidelines. If you think you'd like more specifics, take a minute to download my 2-page PDF packed with video links and references on the absolute essentials of how to start ADHD medications. They're easily available at corebrainjournal.com/start. Thanks for listening. Do connect and stay tuned. Together we can make a difference.